You're listening to Sideshow Network. Check out all of our shows at SideshowNetwork.tv.
This episode of Storyworthy is brought to you in part by Plated.com. Prepare chef-quality meals in 30 minutes or less with Plated. Head on over to Plated.com/story and you'll get free shipping with your first order. That's Plated.com/story.
Storyworthy Media. The best in story-driven content.
Hey, it's Jonathan Shaw, and you're addicted to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from Moe's Irish Pub in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Why? Because we're here to see the band Milwaukee's Addiction. Heavy metal, baby.
Is that a new band or an old band?
It is a new band. They are fabulous. They are ready to go. They're ready to burst onto the scene.
And so we're and back I'm not, in Milwaukee.
Because I couldn't find any place that they treat addiction in Milwaukee.
Well, I'm sure they do have places because people are addicted to things all over the place.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure they do. I just didn't. I actually had a cousin who was a cokehead.
Oh, really?
And I thought, that doesn't fit in with Wisconsin at all. You need to drink a lot of beer.
Yeah.
Maybe smoke a lot of pot. That's about it.
You know, I actually had a cousin also who was addicted to cocaine, and he passed away. And he was like in his 30s, and his heart blew up.
Jesus.
You know?
So he was like, he didn't get any help, I guess.
No, he didn't get any help.
30 years.
Very young. I know, very young.
Now, you yourself, made me think of it. You have indulged in the past.
Oh, I've indulged in everything, but I've never been addicted to anything, you know, except for the fact that I like to indulge in things. No, that's an addiction right
you're
there.
You're addicted to travel.
Addiction to travel? Nah, I'm not. Not at all. Talking about addiction tonight, because we have with us tonight author Jonathan Shaw.
Yes.
And he brings forth the topic addiction.
Yes.
And I know what he's going to talk about is from his book, Narcissa. And, you know, Jonathan has quite a history, Hannes.
Yes.
He was a heroin addict.
Ooh.
So I know there's some of that addiction in there.
Awesome.
And I think once you become a heroin addict, I think everything else just falls
into
line. I think
that's the major leagues. You know,
single
A is marijuana, double A would be cocaine, triple A.
You can't get addicted to marijuana. Let me just put that out there right now.
That's right.
You really
can't.
Right. That's
by the way, this is a refreshing break from all the acid stories we have recently.
We have
had such
so many.
A huge amount of acid stories. So I'm looking forward to a good heroin story.
Well, you know, I was thinking about addiction, and I actually looked at the actual definition. And it says it's a state that is characterized by compulsive engagement in rewarding stimuli, despite adverse consequences.
Ah.
See what I mean? And so it says it can be thought of as a disease or biological process leading to such behaviors.
Okay, that actually sounds like a description of doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah, well, what
you're
they are.
Just addicted to try and do it despite adverse.
Because it's addictive stimuli, and that is positively reinforcing you and then intrinsically rewarding you.
But the reward is short-lived.
Right, but it reinforces, the behavior reinforces that you're going to get rewarded.
Yeah.
Now, the addiction can be anything. It could be an exercise addiction, food addiction, drug addiction, computer addiction, my favorite, sex addiction.
Yeah.
Shopping addiction, gambling addiction. I mean, by the way, the whole thing when I just said sex addiction, I dated a guy a long time ago, and I'm 72 years old now.
Yes, so this by dated, you mean...
No, but listen, he was truly like addicted to porn, right?
Yeah.
And he told me a story one time that his ex-wife was a flight attendant, and he and I was a flight attendant at the time, and he would look forward to her leaving on a trip because then, you know, he could watch porn. But he said one time she left, and so he watches his porn, and then he's so mad at himself because it's this cycle, right? And he's mad at himself that he can't be intimate, and he's mad, so he takes all of his porn and he takes it out to the dumpster and he throws it all away and he gets rid of all his porn and he goes back home and he does his thing and he falls asleep and he wakes up in the middle of the night and what does he do?
Goes and buys more porn.
No, he gets the porn out of the trash.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? That didn't end it. You can't just say, I'm done now. You know what I mean? Or can
well,
you?
Yeah. Well, no, I think is what that seems to me like that would be a pretty standard repetitive thing where you'd be like, I'm disgusted with myself and I'm done. And then you go back.
It was sad, though, in terms of that particular addiction, because he couldn't be he couldn't be pleased. It wasn't. So it was
yeah,
such a
sad
thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not
thing.
Right. It sounds like, well, porn, that's not really going to hurt your food. But it's like I from what I understand, and I am so unexpert at this, it's more like. You can take – it doesn't matter whether the thing you're doing has a pleasurable aspect to it. You're taking the pleasure out of it by being compelled to do it. Because sex addiction sounds like, yeah, I'm getting a lot of sex. But a sex addiction
–
all I learned about sex addiction is from Cheers when Ted Danson went to a sexual addiction, guys. But
everything
it's like
I
you're
know.
Obsessed with sex to the point where it's like it's not even pleasurable. It's like
no, it was a job.
Yeah, it's a job to find some
and
random
he could
person.
Never be,
you could, to have
couldn't
sex
please
with.
Him. So it was just like boring. It was horrible. It was horrible. I felt degraded. I mean, it wasn't pleasurable. And for the fact that he was so beautiful, it was sick that he couldn't figure that out. He didn't know that was enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was a professional.
How long did you go out with this guy?
Professional soccer player for a while. I mean, just like steel, you know, but it didn't. He didn't care.
Sounds like you're addicted to.
Well, let me tell you something. A couple of years, it worked out very well.
Yeah.
The term addiction is also sometimes applied to compulsions that are not substance related, like we're saying, the compulsive shopping, overeating, gambling. Do you ever know anybody that was addicted to shopping?
No.
That's a very sad one as well.
But I know, and this will sound like I'm just being a smartass, but I think that a lot of women in America are borderline. Like some people will – I know that Sherry sometimes – she's not addicted to it. But sometimes if she's having a bad day and she wants to calm down, she'll go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't need any of the stuff and she doesn't buy like some crazy thing. But she doesn't even have to buy anything.
Didn't she buy a car one time that was sort of a snafu?
It was a snafu because – she didn't research enough, but she was able to return it. But that was she always wanted that car.
It was just a car.
She wanted that car. But like, you know, she'll the act, I think to a lot of women, the act of going through the store and finding things you might want and going to another store and comparing them is in itself calming, which I actually understand. Like sometimes I would just go to pre-internet. Kids, there was a time when you couldn't get on the web and go to Wikipedia and go
Tell
down the rabbit hole.
Tell us about it, Hannes.
Well, you go down to the library. I would go to the library and just wander the aisles, and then I'd see a book, and I'd pick it up, and that would make me think of something, and then I would go find something else about that, which is like on Wikipedia, but you can't do it in your underwear because they throw you out of the
library
unless the ACLU backs you up. So just that, that would calm me down.
Yeah.
That would calm me down. So you can't say I was addicted to libraries, but on the other hand, it had a quality of, you know, it's like I'm addicted. I mean, I might be addicted to fatty foods. I'm not kidding. Except it is possible for me to not eat fatty foods, but I've never gone more than a week without eating something that's bad for me. That's never happened. I mean, I've been like, I'm going to be a good boy. I'm not going to have any fries. I'm not going to do this. A week later, I'm going to be – at some point, I'll be like, I need a bratwurst.
I see. Well, I think I was just going to go back to the shopping one. I think that's also a very sad addiction because when you don't need something and you think that can somehow fulfill you, just having like the bag in your house and like – you know what I mean? And there's tags and then there's plastic like that. It's just sad because it's not going to do anything. The rush is so short-lived.
Yeah, it's also
and
sad because it's
buy
like –
something else.
Talk about first world problems.
You're trying to keep up with like a style or image and it's like how – you can't keep up because it's designed to change.
Right. It's planned obsolescence.
So it's kind of – I'm really glad – that's all I'm saying. I'm glad I don't have the shopping problem and I'm glad I don't have the sex problem. That's all
I'm saying. Hang on. We have to take a break. Christine needs to take a hit off her bong.
I'm not taking the hit today. So listen, we've got a great storyteller coming up today and he's going to talk about addiction, author Jonathan Shaw. Did I tell you where I met Jonathan, Hannes?
I'm going to guess at the bookstore that you work at.
It wasn't a bookstore. It was an art center, Barnesville Art Center. But it was associated with the bookstore thing.
Okay.
And, you know, Jonathan used to be a tattoo artist. He may still do tattoos. I'm not sure. I think both of my tattoos, embarrassing. I'm not going to show them.
Okay. Well, you had one on your hip from a million years ago.
No, that one's not that long ago. That one's only like 15 years old.
Oh, okay. Is there another one?
Like Jonathan
I know about?
Was like, hello. Yeah, there is. And you know what, Hannes? There is. How do you like that?
But this was before all the kids were doing it.
I got my first tattoo when I was 21 years old at the Denver Stock Show. Yeah. And I'm lucky
and
I didn't get branded.
This was actually, Colorado was not a state yet. They were still a territory.
That's exactly right. All right, you guys, before we bring our storyteller on, I did want to mention that if you'd like to support the Storyworthy podcast, that would be fantastic. And here's what you can do. Buy my book.
Right. Go through
Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life. It's available on Amazon, Kindle, and of course the audiobook, or you can get it the old-fashioned way in paperback over at storyworthymedia.com.
Yes, an actual thing, a physical thing that you will have in your house.
Did you read my book, Hannes?
I've heard those stories so many fucking times that I skimmed through it and went, know that one.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, no, I've heard the story.
You can also follow us on Twitter and over at the Facebook, and you know the things to do.
Yeah. Just tell your friends.
That's the basic thing you can
do. If you like us, tell your friends, and if you don't like us, tell your enemies.
That's fine. We don't care where the numbers come from. Stitcher, SoundCloud,
iTunes. Yeah, if you hate us, we still want downloads.
That's exactly right. Okay, you guys, wherever you are, stick around because Jonathan Shaw is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have writer Maggie Rowe.
And I will be talking about my grandma, Levine.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hey, Hannes, let's talk about our new sponsor, Plated. Okay, I got my first Plated box the other day, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, you put this up on Facebook, and I was very impressed. It was gyros.
Steak gyros is
gyros.
What it was.
Yes.
Heroes, gyros, whatever you want to call it. It was so much fun opening the box. My daughter and I, we just had such a great time looking at all of the produce, everything they sent. And you put it all out on the counter, and they give you little suggestions on how to make it even more special, like after you're done cutting the lemon, and, you know, put half of it over the steak and put the other half in a decorative vase of water. You know,
sure.
It was like, oh, wait a minute.
Vase not included.
Look at me. I am like Martha Stewart over here. I'm like really cooking.
I know. And it's like, and the reason I was impressed with gyros is that's a tough thing to make at home.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can make, you know, spaghetti. It's like, no, but I mean, I couldn't even start.
Yeah.
To, like, what do I need to buy exactly? So this is where this comes in. It's a fantastic idea. You get all the ingredients. They're perfectly measured. You got all the spices. You got the instructions. And you could impress a date very much. I'm dating, but you're dating the entire world. So you could impress
people.
Yeah,
that's exactly right, Hannes. I'm dating the entire world.
Yes.
What are they talking about? All right, you guys. Prepare chef-quality meals in 30 minutes or less with Plated. So head on over to Plated.com/story right now, and you'll get free shipping with your first order. Once again, you guys, Plated.com/story.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Valley, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We've left Moe's in Wauwatosa, and we're on the east side of Milwaukee, where I feel comfortable, at Hooligans.
Oh, my gosh. Is that like the Irish pub with the green and the thing, right?
No, it is. It's a bar, but it's not very Irish pubby. It's just the Milwaukee bar.
I see.
But it's on one of those.
It sounds so boring. It sounds vanilla.
Oh, no. You would enjoy it.
All right.
Because it's, and for instance, it's a weird shape because we're on like one of those triangle corners.
Okay.
You know where like three streets come together?
Yes.
And like everything looks like a boat. It's that kind of a place.
Everything
it's
looks
awesome.
Like a boat. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Jonathan Shaw. He is a novelist and a blogger. He's also a spoken word performer, a witch doctor, an anti-folk hero, and an underground philosopher. His cult classic novel, Narcissa, has been re-released on Johnny Depp's Infinitum Nil imprint with HarperCollins. Now, you can find him over at jonathanshawworks.com. And on Facebook, he's also known as Jonathan Shaw Works. And you can find him on Twitter at JS Fun City. Wherever you are, folks, put your hands together for Jonathan Shaw.
So I'm going to read an excerpt from Narcissa, Our Lady of Ashes. This book, it's dealing with different aspects of addiction. And the protagonist, she's addicted to crack cocaine. And the narrator, the other protagonist in this book, is addicted to her crack. This is a classic story of addiction and co-addiction. In this case, sex and love addiction, codependency, whatever you want to call it. And anyway, in this excerpt that I'm going to read... she's been up for like 5 days smoking crack, and And, you know, with all the attendant weirdness going on. And finally, he's had enough. So he put some downers in her juice and dosed her, basically. And finally, she passed out. So this is what is going on as she's passed out. So before she passes out, she's on his laptop looking, resurrecting like old emails from a year before. And before she became totally addicted to crack cocaine, she was basically a whore. So, you know, a lot of Johns and tricks were contacting her via her email, and he's now sort of – she passed out with her emails open on his laptop, so he's going to go – sort of surf through the deranged world of her, you know, whore mails. So with the TV blaring, Narcissa passed out, wearing two pairs of pants and a makeshift chastity belt, with her grimy combat boots propped up on my pillow and the dirty pink motorcycle helmet still fastened to her head, she snored the rest of the day away. And her email sat open on the table, calling out to me like a glowing white loony ward. Like a man in a trance, I went over and stared at the screen. Powerless to resist, I sat. My finger hesitated over the cursor. Then I did it. I opened up Pandora's inbox and drove into a stinking nightmare swamp of outdated whore correspondence. Horrespondence, if you will. A grim archaeological dig into a burnt-out, ruined netherworld of hooker hustle, the whore of Babylon's mad realm. My stomach froze as I dug like a soot-faced miner, burrowing down, down, deeper and deeper into that dark, uncharted tunnel, into the site, the tomb, the wound, into the land of 1,000 Johns, 1,000 Tricks, 1,000 Vicks, 1,000... Tricks and 1,000 swinging dicks. Unable to stop, I read on, one email at a time. Hey, little cutie, it's me, Fabio. Remember? You came over to my place in Copacabana over Carnival, and we partied, and you spent the night, and I really want to see you again. Here's my number. Call me. Ah, delete. Then I hit pay dirt, an unread email from the estranged husband. It was months old, asking if she was dead or alive, wanting to know where to send the divorce papers. I kept reading, digging down, down into the wreckage of ashes and ghosts and demons, raping my mind, skull-fucking my bloody eyes out. And as I read the next one, my soul froze. What the fuck? Narcissa had been working on some other guy, some random gringo sex tourist, right before I took her in. Look at this shit. It's from the same day I found her in Copacabana. I kept reading, dusting off the pieces, digging deeper, and it hurt. A smarmy spasm of jealousy reared its ancient reptilian head in my heart like the Loch Ness monster, bubbling up from a stinking maudlin swamp of dark, unhappy emotions. But I couldn't stop digging. Down, down, down I went, like a diligent archaeologist, an impartial scientist, a suicide kamikaze pilot to hell. And with a gut-chilling wave of disgust, I stared at the gringo's words. When you kissed me that night on the beach. Ah, what? When she kissed him? What the fuck? This guy says he's never been kissed with such passion. A gringo, some shit-eating, pink-faced little foreign clerk. A goddamn fuck tourist, some anonymous trick. Bitch, she never kissed me. But she was kissing some faceless, nameless gringo shit-fuck with passion? Miserable, poisonous cow. Dirty, backstabbing whore. I wondered if I would ever recover from loving Narcissa. I wanted to scream. I wanted to gouge my eyes out with a fucking spoon. I didn't. I just sat there reading the rest of the email, and the one after that, and the one after that. As Narcissa snored the hours away, I went through all of them. There were dozens, but I kept going back to that one stinging nightmare message reeking of the tomb of ancient rejection and betrayal. A gringo, another sucker, another trick, another savior, another hustle, another clit-twiddling wanker, another man. some random ass-faced foreigner, Austrian, German, Swiss, whatever. Another white knight from some nice, clean, logical, safe, milk-fed, well-groomed, prosperous little European shithole with photo attachments of the stupid Mameluke standing in the snow. Fucking pine trees jutting out of the white powder like demon fingers reaching up from hell. Grinning like a fat, overfed Cheshire cat in his well-bred, well-adjusted, wealthy little gringo winter wonderland like fucking Santa Claus. Arrogant little beer-swilling piss monkey standing there in his pretty pastel-colored sporty gringo ski clothes, skiing the Swiss Alps or the Matterhorn or the fucking Mount Everest. Go shit up a fucking pine tree, you goofy little ass clown. As I read on, picturing Narcissa with this gringo together, all of a sudden I started laughing. The bitter death grin cackle of a murdered little ghost. Fuck, some shit-brained gringo trick. Bitch, fucking whore was hijacking another dumb bastard all along. And right under my clueless fucking nose, another magic gringo to swoop down and rescue her and carry her off to his neat, civilized, law-abiding, Swiss Army knife, chocolate factory, clockwork yodeling Nazi world of fairy tale dreams and twinkling Disneyland happy endings. Knockwurst chomping master race prick, all dressed up in his fancy state-of-the-art high-tech German ski gear. Looking at the gringo's pictures, I conjured an image of Narcissa out on the slopes, skiing in designer black leather German underwear, flying through the snowy pines at supersonic silver speed, a crack pipe dangling from her breathless blue lips, and a Bible tucked under her arm, shouting, screaming, raving, "Sinners! Sinners! Ah! You all going to hell! Go, go! Move, stupid!" Hallucinating from sleep deprivation, the night was a long waking nightmare of betrayal. And I kept going back to that email again and again, seething at the realization that she'd spent her last days before me hustling in the long whore tradition of her mother's godforsaken race of whores, trying to reel in some other poor fool, just like her mother's grandmother's whoring mother's man-murdering whore ghost before her, and on down the line of snatch-peddling strumpets and floozies and good-time girls and backstabbing, black-hearted, sidewalk-slithering trollops, all the way back to when they were all whore cave women, bartering their beet-red whore monkey asses for bunches of green bananas. Suddenly I heard a faint sound of dry, bloody bones echoing in my ear. The Dakini was coming. I could hear her approaching, dancing into the long, dark, hazy night of my soul, hypnotizing me, holding me riveted to the screen, getting closer and closer, rattling down the lonely road to nowhere, whirling and gyrating her wild, feverish, Whore of Babylon Dakini dance, grabbing me, dragging me down, down into the pulsing depths of a wound that never closes, never heals, never mends, never ends. "Hey, little cutie, it's Fabio. Remember me? You came over to my place during Carnival, and we partied, and you spent the night. I really want to see you again. Here's my number. Call me." The spirits increase. Vigor grows through a wound. "You don't want to get involved with me, Cigano. If you go down this road together with me now, you can never look back. I'm not going to stay all alone and wait for you to come back." The spirits increase. "I must say, I really miss being kissed, kissed, kissed by a girl, kissed, kissed, kissed by a girl with so much passion, so much passion, so much passion, passion, passion. I hope you're well, little sweetie, little cutie, little sweetie. Take care of yourself. Love, Hans." Take care of yourself? What? Take care of yourself? Why? How? Fuck! That would defeat the whole fucking purpose of being Narcissa, of being the whore of Babylon, this heartless, merciless, stone-faced bitch of a pagan idol I have worshipped and given my stinking, defeated lifeblood to feed and be fed to forever. I looked up from the computer to Narcissa's crashed-out carcass littering my sofa, and the spirits increased. bringing me back to the beginning, back to when I'd first met her, back to when she was still the charming waif, the beguiling hostage taker, the enticing little acid queen, before her mask melted away to expose the stone-cold heart of an unsmiling succubus, a false idol to love that wasn't love at all, but its psychotic two-headed twin of domination and grabby, crabby, clingy dependency, that frigid, murderous, malevolent bitch of addiction, drawing me closer and closer till I'd put my throbbing, raw, bleeding red heart into her filthy, cracked, blackened crab claw again and again until she really finally had me. And then she yanked open the gates of hell, releasing the demons, the spirits, the spooks, the hobgoblins and ghouls to extract their fiendish retribution. Because the one who'd first drawn me in, the smiling one, the dancing one, the homeless waif with a cosmic fishbowl and a need I thought I could fill with my tainted, crippled love, now she was gone. Now only Medusa remained, snarling, spitting, snakes hissing, spewing ashes from her tangled, lethal dreadlocks of hell-bent doom and eternal bondage of self-obsession and wants. I must say, Narcissa, I really miss being kissed by a girl with so much passion, passion, passion. The girls here are all so cold in Germany. I hope you're well. Take care of yourself, little sweetie. Love, Hans. Love, Hans. Love, Hans. Hans, Hans. This Hans's words were stuck in my brain like a sticky strand of half-chewed bubblegum. As I sat reading the gringo's email again and again, sinking deeper into that festering swamp of jealousy and betrayal and regret, I remembered a night in Copacabana when some little whore had stuck her bubblegum in my hair while sitting behind me on the motorcycle. Another girl on the host roll had told me the only way to get rid of it was to cut out the gummy strands of hair, and that was what I'd done with her help. What was her name, anyway? I screwed her twice and gave her a nice tip. She was a good egg, that one. I read the email again. I really miss being kissed by a girl with so much passion. Love, Hans. Hans. Shit. Another poor, clueless bastard she tried to run off with. Because like me, Narcissa always tried to run from the pain of her existence. Even if she couldn't run because the pain was inside her, tattooed onto every rancid, corrupt cell of her being, the indelible portrait of an abandoned child. And if she couldn't run to drugs or to Jesus or to Ashtar or Mickey Mouse, Narcissa always ran to people. She could jump right into your soul and suck it dry as the desert sands of Alpha Centauri, trying to dodge the pain of being in her own inconvenient, miserable, tortured, passionate beggar's psyche. Passion, 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 passion. I couldn't get the gringo's haunting, taunting words out of my head. Kissed with passion. Was this fucker talking about the same Narcissa I knew? She never kissed me. Not since the first week we were together, back when she was still roping me in, fattening me up for this hellish slaughter. But after that, it was months before she ever let me kiss her again, always turning her face away, clamping her lips shut like a clam, like I was trying to shove a fucking poison dart into her mouth or something. Shit. Only months later, after I'd marched through the gauntlet of clamoring demons in the torture chambers of a screaming medieval hell to get her back, after I'd proved myself 100 times as a worthwhile hostage, an asset, a sucker, a chump, a doormat, a worthy adversary, only then had she finally kissed me again. Ah, but when she did, it was as addictive as everything else about her. Nibbling away at her soul in passionate little bites as I fucked her, and we disintegrated into a lingering humid mist of lust, running my tongue long and slow across her teeth, her crazy pink bubblegum lips, drinking in her essence like a mad sex-crazed vampire, inhaling her insane fevered breath like a crackhead sucking in the lethal smoke. And suddenly I got it. Jesus, fuck, that's it. Kissed with passion. Fuck. Maybe that tight-ass, beer-swilling, Nazi-Aryan fuckwit Hans didn't know it, but I knew what all that so-called passion was. I knew its smell and its taste and its effect, like I know the smell of boiling heroin in a bent blackened spoon as I hold a trembling match under it, preparing the next crucial fix to jam into a screaming, yearning, hungry black and blue vein. It's the passion of desperation, and only another addict could ever be attracted to that shit. For guys like Hans, when it's time to go back home to Austria or Germany or Bulgaria or wherever, back to Stuttgart, back to Gringolandia, back to Lipschitz, back to the bank, it's just time to go, and that's that. Not for an addict like me. For me, that mirror image desperation kiss was the kiss of death, the devil's kiss. And it's addictive as crack or heroin or chocolate or hang gliding. Doesn't matter what it is, it's all addictive. It's the bloody, screaming, monkey-ass banging human condition. Peanut butter milkshakes, miniature golf, television, computer games, work, sleep, sports, whatever. Anything, everything. Because the addiction isn't in the substance, whatever it is. It's in the mind. And that's why Narcissa was so hard for me to ever put down. Because you can put down the crack, the booze, the milkshake, the girl, the boy, the billy goat, the vibrating dildo, the heroin, the fucking church bingo, whatever. You can put it all down again and again and again. But you can never shut down the mind. Even after the brain is dead, blown to wiggling, tormented, quivering smithereens. Because the mind lives on forever. You can kill the body, but the mind will never stop chattering away in the depths of your being like some insane, blazing, black-hearted, ring-tailed monkey sitting in a screaming, bleeding tree whose poisonous roots reach all the way down to hell. That's why people like Narcissa and I just keep running and running and running, jumping into other people's souls, seeking relief where there can be no relief. Unsettled, restless, and discontent, looking for that glow-in-the-dark, day-glow plastic Jesus to save us. People like us just keep running and running, trying to outrun the eternal plague of ourselves.
Wow, Jonathan, that is so strong.
By the way,
so fabulous.
The number one moral I'm taking away, never trust a guy named Hans. Or Hannes, or Johannes. We're all
like
bad.
Hey, listen, that there is so much beauty in those words. Wow, man, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was very okay. There's two names that come to mind that I'm assuming are influenced you. Hunter S. Thompson, it's obvious. Henry Miller. Are those guys influences on you?
You know, I've read Hunter Thompson, and I've read Henry Miller extensively, and yeah, I mean, those are, you know, I don't know how much.
Now, Rolling Stone magazine recently called you. They said tattoo artist Jonathan Shaw, can he become the next Bukowski? Or no, it says how legendary tattoo artist Jonathan Shaw became the next Bukowski. Those are big words.
Bukowski was a huge influence on me, not so much, you know, stylistically, because I don't write like Bukowski. You know, I probably, you know, if I was to sort of impartially look at this stuff, because I don't strive to write like anybody. You know, I try to write like Jonathan Shaw.
Yeah.
You know, Bukowski was a huge influence, not stylistically, but just ideologically, and I knew the man really well.
You know, oh, you did? Oh,
yeah, okay. I knew Bukowski before he was famous. You know, back in the early 70s, I knew Bukowski.
Yeah, and I have a quote here about you guys. You said, it says, we were both screaming drunk one time, you said, Jonathan Shaw said. And Bukowski said to me, you're just a fucking punk kid living in Hollywood. Who wants to read about that? You need to get a fucking life so you have something to write about. And then we went to blows. And you fought.
Yeah, we traded punches.
What did he mean by that, do you think?
Well, what he meant by that turned out to be very prophetic. I mean, at the time we were both drunk and I took offense to him calling me a punk kid and, you know, I called him an old fart and then we, you know, we sort of grappled around and, you know, our friendship began that night because, you know, nobody killed each other. And we, you know, we wound up drinking the night away and toasting to each other's speedy demise. And we had a sort of, you know, sort of a ball-breaking relationship over the, you know, over the years. And we were you know.
This is in Los Angeles.
This was in L.A. This was before he moved to San Pedro. It was before Black Sparrow. It was before he got, before Bukowski was famous or even.
So where did you guys hang out?
No, he had this crappy little apartment over in East Hollywood, and you know, he would sort of hold court there, and you know,
he worked at the post office the whole time he was writing.
I think,
right?
He'd already quit the post office, but he had not had any real success as a writer. He had a weekly column in the LA Free Press, and I was writing for an offshoot of the Free Press, and that's how I found out where he lived, and I went over there one afternoon with a case of beer and some whiskey, and just knocked on his window, and that's how I got to know him. But you know, the things that he told me basically were very prophetic. You know, he was basically like, you're never going to be a writer because you got nothing to write about. I was probably, you know, 18 years old at the time, 17, 18, 19 years old during the years I knew him. And he told me, you know, you're not going to be a writer because you got nothing to write about. And that was true. I mean, I just, you know, I wound up strung out on heroin, and I left Los Angeles, hitchhiked to Mexico with no money, and hoboed around Mexico for several years, and wound up in South America working on ships.
Now, when you were hitchhiking through Central America, were you addicted to heroin at that time?
No. I left Los Angeles to get off of heroin.
Now, we should back up and say that your father is legendary. He was a clarinetist, correct?
Yeah.
Artie Shaw.
Yeah.
I listened to a bunch of his stuff because I knew I was going to meet you. So I Spotify'd Artie Shaw. And as you know, he was amazing.
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely
just that big
amazing
band sound, which was so fabulous. So when you grow up with a man like that,
I didn't grow up with
he wasn't
father.
In your life.
No, he wasn't in my life.
Yeah.
He abandoned me in the cradle.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, Papa was a Rolling Stone. So he took off, and him and my mother had a, you know, very short, very tumultuous, violent, unhappy relationship. They stayed together basically just long enough to spawn me. And my mother fucked off to California with me as a baby. My mother was a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
Doris Dowling. Doris Dowling, yeah. Her starring, one of her big roles was in the Billy Wilder movie, The Lost Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And so she moved to California with me. I never saw my father again.
Now, I read somewhere he was married like 8 times.
Yeah, he was a sex and love addict, big time.
Now what
and
now?
He also had a, you know, he was in the habit of marrying alcoholic women. So, you know, my mother was an alcoholic, God rest her soul, and she died of alcoholism, and she led a very tortured and unhappy life. Which, you know, it doesn't take Sigmund Freud to, you know, to sort of understand my history of addiction and alcoholism, and also my longstanding attraction to, you know, broken people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
which is sort of the fertile soil
for Narcissa.
For a book like Narcissa to emerge.
And
from.
You did know a woman named Narcissa.
I've
So your attraction to broken women is that you can save them or help them, or do you also, you know, you assimilate with them?
Well, you know, I'm a recovering codependent in that, you know, I don't roll that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't roll that way.
Well, because you've been educated, right? Or you have a different perspective?
I have a different perspective, yeah. You know, I understand that co-alcoholism is a disease just like alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
you know, and co-addiction is a disease just like addiction, you know. I mean, any good card-carrying addict has to have their enabler.
The codependent close person.
At hand. So when you say co-alcoholism, you mean one's an alcoholic and one's not, technically, but they're
sometimes,
together.
Sometimes, you know, they can both be alcoholics sometimes, yeah. or addicts, you know, same difference, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, an addict an alcoholic is just an addict who's addicted to alcohol, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, but a lot of, you know, alcoholism or addiction, whatever you want to call it, you know, is a state of consciousness by which, you know, it's almost like a living entity in its own right, and it occupies the host, Mm-hmm. You know, the way I see it, you know, alcoholism or addiction is like it's an entity and like any other, and it, you know, it needs a host in order to survive and do its thing, you know, and like any entity in God's creation, its primary purpose is to survive
at all costs. That's powerful. I mean, to know that is so empowering, I'm sure. Did you go through a drug rehab to get to this point, or how many drug rehabs?
I've never been to a rehab.
Really?
No. I've never been to any sort of...
You never went away for the weekend and they never broke you down and you had to cry and stuff?
No.
That's
no,
good.
No.
And so when you grew up the way
I belong to a community of like-minded recovering addicts and alcoholics, and you know, we share our experience, strength, and hope with each other, but you know, to solve our common problem. But
is that like a group we would know? Is it a standard group, or is it just a group of your friends?
Well, I cannot
disclose it.
I can't say.
Yeah,
but you have people to talk to. People who understand what you're talking about.
It's a way of life. Yeah, I mean, you know, we adapt certain spiritual principles into our consciousness. And then we put them into action in our lives. And, you know, it's a spiritual redemptive kind of situation. You know, I mean, you know, some people go to religion. Other people go to, you know, a lifestyle that embodies certain spiritual principles that, you know, that can and will expel the obsession to drink and take drugs and mm-hmm. enable the addict to.
So do you think you're addicted to writing?
Well, you know, as an addict, I mean, it's like I'm a recovered addict, so I'm not addicted to, you know, any substance today physically. But, you know, the addict mindset pretty much persists, you know, until they throw dirt on you. So, you know, in that sense, I'm, you know, by nature, I've pretty much had to come to accept that by nature, I'm compulsive and I'm obsessive about pretty much everything I do. So, you know, so it's more of a matter of, you know, how am I going to channel that? You know, it's kind of like a certain alchemy that we practice by which we can turn shit to gold, because the shit is there and it ain't going away. So, you know, how can I best, you know, deal with what I've got, you know, as a character trait, and how to channel that into something positive, constructive, creative, as opposed to something that's self-destructive and, you know, and horrible and is going to affect the world in a negative way.
Do you ever teach? Have you ever taught?
Well, I am a teacher.
You are a teacher.
I mean, by nature. I mean, as a writer, I don't say this in an arrogant way, because, you know, I've been given a gift, you know, by whatever forces are, you know, existent, you know, have given me a certain gift, you know, gift of expression, creative expression, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, for me, any kind of gift that one receives is, you know, it's a blessing and it's a gift. It's a great thing. And on the other hand, it's a huge, you know, it comes with a huge responsibility. And the responsibility is to, you know, educate, inform, enlighten, teach, share with others that which I've been given, that's part of the deal.
And you got to create content.
Well, yeah. I mean, I write.
Do you have a process in writing? Do you sit down every day for a couple of hours, or what's?
No, I sometimes I'll sit in a room and write for 16 hours a day.
Oh my gosh! Really?
You know, for months on end, and then, you know, I might go fishing for a few days.
What kind of fishing do you like to do?
No, I mean, I say that metaphorically.
Because fishing is a fine sport.
Well, I like to eat fish, but I don't like to catch them.
I see. You don't need to see them dangling on a hook.
No, it's okay.
Do you use an iPad, a computer, or are you writing with pen and paper?
All of the above.
Really?
Yeah.
I wrote most
of this book on a BlackBerry, actually.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Some people now, you can use a translation, you know, program where you just talk into the iPhone and it translates it.
I wouldn't like that.
Yeah.
A BlackBerry, that seems so. You've got the tiny keyboard. That's.
Well, this book originally came out in 2008.
Yeah.
And then they re-released it.
Yeah. Well, I spent a few years meticulously editing it for this new edition, because, you know, this is like HarperCollins, baby. So,
yeah,
you know, I had to make sure.
Yeah.
Every word is so valuable. Like, I'm listening to you read the story and every word is so valuable. And I was just thinking about your editing process. You have a copy editor, of course, but when you yourself are going through it, there's so many details.
Well, I like to edit, you know, meticulously. I mean, I edit compulsively, obsessively, like pretty much everything else I do. So I'm a perfectionist by nature. And I probably, you know, did like two or three major edits on this book, you know, where you know, there was actual, you know, chapters were revised and, you know, changed around and, you know, new material was mm-hmm. added and old material was subtracted and, you know, like a big edit there. I probably did about three big editing passes through this book. And then I probably did, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 other passes yeah. through the book, you know, where mm-hmm. I just...
You know, every yeah.
and honed and, you know,
do you have pruned. To say the words out loud before you decide on the final order?
You know, that's funny. I probably should have, but I didn't. I was not a big reader, you know, reading out loud until the book came out. And
yeah, and that's a different genre. It's like how it lays on the page is very mm-hmm. important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how it actually looks, the paragraph. Yeah.
By the way, so this is from Johnny Depp's imprint under HarperCollins. And if this is ever made into a movie, Johnny Depp will use your look. Because you look like exactly like what Johnny Depp wants to the hair, the
Johnny
goatee.
Johnny Depp has been modeling himself after me.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, see, so it's backwards. I got it backwards.
You sure did. I was the original inspiration for a lot of his
yeah,
his
that's
stuff,
awesome. You know? I can totally see that.
And it was probably not a conscious thing on his part. We just hung around so much together that he, you know, something in him just reached out, you know, because he's like a parrot. Like yeah. any really great actor, you know, he has that gift of being able to just morph into other people.
Yeah. yeah.
And that's how he can, you know, he's basically a medium. He channels spirits.
Amazing.
Spirits of the living or the dead. And, you know, I don't think it's a conscious thing like, oh, I'm going to try to dress up like, you know, J.S. and act like him. It's none of that. It's more like, you know, if he hangs out with you long enough, you know, he's going to reach out and
so
pull
you're talking
your soul
about like transcending being an actor then.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what makes a really great artist on any level, whether it's an actor, whether it's a, you know, a painter, a writer, you know, whatever, a comedian, a poet, you know, these are people who, you know, who have a connection to the spirit world. And like I say, it might not be a developed or conscious connection, but it's a connection by which, you know, their spirit reaches out and merges with the spirit of, you know, whatever it is they need to sort of, you know, kind of like vampires in a way, but, you know, they're you know, they're not destructive vampires. They're just, you know, they're parrots. They're people who, you know, can go into the spirit realm and sort of pull the essence out of things and take it into their art. And, you know, we all do that.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's why great actors, you believe, you completely
yeah,
believe.
Yeah, because it's all because the time. It's intuitive and it's natural.
Yeah,
and I actually just wrote a piece about my relationship with Johnny Depp and a time when he actually, you know, channeled Hunter Thompson, and you know Hunter Thompson's
right,
ghost
movie,
appeared
yeah.
before us. And yeah. no, this wasn't this
really.
Oh, yeah. Is it preparing?
This hasn't been published or anything.
And where were you?
We were in Hawaii while he was shooting one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. I've actually got this. It's about 800 words, and I'm shopping it to, you know, Esquire. And
800 words? That's not that long.
No, it's not that long.
So you're talking about one instance when you're with Johnny Depp in Hawaii, and yeah. you're in a seance.
It was a seance, but it was an unconscious seance.
Was there anybody else in the room besides the two of you?
Yeah, there were a couple other people.
And you're in like a hotel room?
We were in a residence where we were staying while he was where he was living while
yeah.
he was filming the last Pirates of the Caribbean.
I bet that was a nice place.
It was a pretty nice place. And Hunter Thompson's ghost, you know, whatever you want to call it, spirit, his ghostly presence was literally conjured up before our eyes.
What did you
itself.
See?
Well, I'm not gonna spoil the story.
You'll have to read the story.
The story's gonna, you know, be in Vanity Fair or GQ or, you know,
but what
like
did you
that.
Hear something?
Well, I'm not gonna tell the story.
You brought
now.
It up.
Yeah, but that's as far as I go.
Oh my
this
God.
Is what we call a tease.
Here's yeah. here's something. Here's a quote from you, Jonathan Shaw, and you're doing it right now to me. Comforting the upset and upsetting the comfortable.
That's my motto.
All right, let me ask you something. Did you or did you not meet your father?
Oh yeah. After, you know, after I sobered up and I was in my 40s, you know, as part of my sort of psychic regeneration process, you know, I made an attempt to reach out to this man who, you know, I held such, you know, deep, you know, wounds from, you know, just the parental wounds that basically inform, you know, our crooked path in life. And, you know, I knew that I was going to have to make peace with my circumstances in so many areas of my life. If I was going to stay sober, I was going to stay off drugs and live, you know, a, you know, a productive lifestyle, that, you know, I knew that I would have to meet this man and come to terms with him being my father and, you know, get to know him and find some forgiveness.
How many children did he have?
He had two.
That's it, just two kids.
Yeah, I didn't even know my half-brother. I didn't know my half-brother.
Is he alive?
Not that I know of.
And so your father, when you say you made peace, so you went to lunch with him?
I spent a lot of time with him. I went to visit him on a regular basis. And, you know,
that was very good, wasn't it?
Very old. And, yeah, I mean, it was unpleasant in a lot of ways because, you know, he was a real bastard, you know, and he never – you know, he was unable to ever sort of hold himself accountable for having abandoned, you know, children because, he didn't like the fact that I reminded him of my mother, which was, he went to his grave laboring under the delusion that he was some kind of victim. of his own self-created circumstances, which is a really miserable way to live, and it's a miserable way to die.
I feel like there's so many people like that. There are so many people who are just, and those people are on Twitter usually.
No, but
they're
just
like endless.
So,
like,
so
why
lonely.
Is society doing this to me?
That's the plague of our, you know, of our human condition. The delusional concept that we are somehow not responsible for our own circumstances really, you know, is what creates the enemy or the otherness, you know, it's the root of all.
Right. And I've said it before on the show.
It's like wars, it's
human
conflicts,
beings
it's divorce,
know how to make divisions.
Yeah.
You know, I've used this example before. You have a bunch of people in Northern Ireland who all look the same, all sound the same, all have the same kind of names. They've decided that they're on different sides of the same religion.
Right.
And it's like, but there's got to be somebody else. Somebody else is wrong.
Right. Because it's too painful for the human being who's essentially a lazy, corrupt, you know, just technological monkey with bad manners. You know, it's really unpleasant to look within and look at our own defects of character, our own shortcomings. It's very unpleasant feeling.
Yeah.
So it's easier to just.
I'm curious about. So, I mean, you're talking to I had a distant relationship with my own father, not as dramatic as yours, but it's like my father wasn't famous. Was it odd to have a father that you didn't know whose name you would hear periodically just somehow in the media?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, for me, it was like until I, you know, came to that place where I was willing to, you know, to sort of combat my own resentments and my own, you know, victim story and put my victim story on the shelf and go like, this is irrelevant. This is not serving my life in any positive manner. Until I was willing to put that shit aside and make the effort to get to know this man in the interest of my own sanity and my own recovery from drug addiction, you know, until that day, which was about 30 years ago, until that time, I went through my life denying that I had a father who was famous. Nobody who knew me knew who my father was. I made a point of not letting anybody know. I was ashamed. I was, I was ashamed. I was angry. I just shut him out of my consciousness, and I kept it that way, and it festered deep inside me, and, you know, came out in all kinds of inappropriate
ways.
So
do you think about how your father was raised? I mean, so what were his issues?
Those are the issues that I've had to explore real deeply in my own search for, you know, forgiveness and for redemption and for understanding and compassion and, you know, all that good stuff. And, you know, those are the subjects that are, you know, deeply inform my other works. I've got other books in progress. I've got a huge, you know, 3-volume multi-generational memoir type novel.
How exciting, yeah.
That, you know, delves deeply into these questions. And, you know, there's a lot of you know, hundreds of hours that I spent sitting with my father in the, you know, sort of last years of his life. And I had a tape recorder going.
Wonderful.
I knew I was going to do this.
Yeah.
And so I kept a tape recorder going during our conversations. And a lot of the dialogue in these books that I'm writing,
there's
conversations between me and him that are like really.
Who taught him music?
Well, he was kind of like self-taught the way I was. You know, we followed a similar path. You know, it's really true what they say that, you know, genetically the apple don't fall far from the tree. You know, like now after, you know, engaging in this quest to sort of know the roots, you know, the ancestral curses and, you know, and everything that goes up to making the matrix of, you know, whatever weird creature I've developed into, you know, I've had to delve deeply into his background and study, you know, his history and know where he came from.
So he's born in like the early 1900s.
Early 1900s, and he was born to, you know, a pair of, you know, Russian immigrants who lived in New York City, you know, in tenement slums of New York City. His father was his father and mother were both tailors and, you know, pretty much illiterate peasants, mm-hmm. you know, and he grew up with this really strong spirit and this quest for something, you know, to rise above his circumstances. And he was entirely, you know, self-educated,
self-taught
man, you know,
amazing.
Brilliant genius, you know, a very, you know, he was a piece of work, man. This guy really, you know, came out, he just came up out of nothing and made his...
How old was he when he passed?
94.
Wow, what a great long life, huh?
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, he had a good run.
No doubt about it. Have you been married, Jonathan?
Well, I've been in a lot of relationships.
But not married?
Yeah, I've been married a couple times.
How about kids?
I have one son who's 30 years old. He's an artist. He lives in South America.
He's an artist. I'm shocked.
Yeah, right.
He's in South America.
Yeah, and he's an accomplished painter.
How exciting!
Yeah,
and you spend a lot of time in Rio de Janeiro.
Well, I pretty much spent about half my life in South America, maybe more.
Wow!
Yeah.
So you obviously love it.
Well, no, it's just where I ended up.
Do you speak Spanish?
I speak fluent Spanish and Portuguese.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know why I care about this. How similar is Portuguese similar to Spanish, or is it a completely different language? I remember reading something people think it's the same.
As languages go, they're probably, you know, fairly close, you know, in some ways, but very, very different in others. So, you know, if you speak fluent Spanish, you might be able to sort of follow Portuguese in writing, but I don't think you could keep up with a real street-level conversation.
Pretendo hablar.
Huh?
Tratando hablar. I'll try.
That's
no?
pretty bad Spanish.
I know, man. What can I say? Hey, listen, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Whatever.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the Storyworthy Wheel of Truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
The beach. Okay, here's the beach. I've always loved the beach. I grew up, in my early years in California, spent a lot of time at the beach. And the beach is probably one of the most creative places for me. I spent, you know, many, many hours sitting near the beach, sitting on a rock by the beach with my BlackBerry in hand, writing this book, Narcissa. The beach has always been a place of great comfort to me, not necessarily beach, but just near the ocean, the water, you know, I'm connected to the water. I it's a good place for me to go and sit and meditate and do some writing, and I love the beach.
How about the mountains? What do you think of the mountains?
Fucking
mountains, man.
Take them or leave them.
No, I agree, because I grew up in Milwaukee, which is on Lake Michigan, which is as big, it looks like an ocean. There's something about being in a city. I can't imagine living in a city that doesn't have
water.
A large body of water next to it.
Yeah.
Like even Kansas City or something.
Yeah,
you're like, it's just land. Everywhere is land.
Yeah, but do you like going into the ocean, like paddleboarding, any you know, surfing?
Oh, I swim a lot, and I body surf. You know, when I'm home in Brazil, I body surf and swim a lot here. I won't go near the water.
Really?
It's fucking freezing, yeah.
But August and September, it really warms up nicely. Really?
Yeah, for a minute, you know. I'm not impressed with the beaches of really? California.
But you well, live on this side of town, don't you?
No.
Where do you live?
I live in Hollywood.
Oh, I see.
An epic journey over here.
I know.
You're
going to
write a whole novel about it.
Odyssey.
We're on the west side. I know. I live in Los Feliz. I do it, too.
This is a weird place to get to.
It's kind of like LAX adjacent, really.
Yeah, you're right by the airport.
Yeah, I know. You come down here and you're like, am I going somewhere? Am I traveling to Europe? What's happening? Yeah. You're like, no, I'm just going to
Is it?
Job.
Yeah, are we in Long Beach? No, you're not. You're here. It's still Los Angeles.
I come from the valley. I still came from the farthest. I went.
Yeah, well, I'm on a motorcycle, so I can get here quickly.
Oh, that's nice. That helps.
Yeah. I didn't have to, you know.
And so do you only ride a motorcycle? Or do you have a car, too?
I own a car, but I rarely use it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except when you get to pick somebody up, or you can still use your bike, I suppose.
Well, my girlfriend, you know, and me, you know, fit very nicely on a motorcycle.
Well, it's a nice configuration.
I believe you're supposed to say my old lady if she's on the back of a motorcycle. Well, I believe legally that's the term.
Well, it'd be hard to call her my old lady because she's, you know, she's
40 years younger.
She literally is.
That's it.
Your 40 years younger.
You've seen her.
My child bride. Okay, great.
Listen now. Do you still do tattoos? Do you still do tattoo art, or you're done with that?
No, I don't do tattooing full time, but I take appointments and tattoo a few select.
Have you tattooed privately. Johnny Depp?
Looks, I did most of his tattoos.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw a couple of pictures of you with him doing his tattoos.
Yeah.
It's such an art now. I mean, I guess it always was, but now it's so much more evident. You see so many more tattoos.
Yeah, well, my next book, the book I've been working on for like 15 years and, you know, I'm still working on, it's a trilogy of books and it's, you know, a real, you know, odyssey. But the title, the working title of the book is Scab Vendor, Confessions of a Tattoo Artist.
Scab Vendor. And you actually have a website, don't you, scabvendor.com?
Yeah, scabvendor.com.
All right.
Yep.
And so what about a coffee table book with some of your art?
That's coming out in the early spring of next year.
See, I called it. I knew that was coming.
I still like the coffee table book that turns into a coffee table from Seinfeld. That's still my favorite coffee table book.
And Kramer made that book with little legs.
It's got a coaster built into it. You know, fantastic.
Well, listen, thank you very much for coming.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
That story was amazing. Well, I mean, just fantastic. Narcissa. And you can find that, of course, at jonathanshawworks.com and also on Amazon.
Well, Amazon, you know, best way to, if you want an autographed copy of the book directly from the author, you can contact me on Facebook, Jonathan Shaw Works, or JS Fun City at Facebook. I have two Facebook pages. One is JS Fun City. The other one is Jonathan Shaw Works. Both on Facebook. You can message me and I can...
You'll hook them up.
Give you an autographed copy of
That's
my book.
Fantastic.
Otherwise, it's on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble.
Did you happen to
everywhere.
Do the audio version?
No, not yet. I would like to.
You should.
Well, I'd like to, but HarperCollins has the rights to that, so I don't know how they want to treat it.
Well, they still might have you read it. You have a great reading voice.
Well, I'm the one, you know, I would be appalled if some fucking goofy actor was to read my work. That would not be cool.
Well, it depends.
Maybe Johnny. Johnny.
I was going to say it depends on who you're
that
talking
would be a big
about.
Seller
well, Johnny's
Johnny
not a goofy
it.
Actor, but you know, but I don't think he likes to read books.
Yeah.
I don't think he likes. I mean, I think he likes to read books.
No, but some
his
people
own
just do.
Reading
it would be very unusual for an actor of his caliber to
sit in a dark room for like about 200
days.
Hours.
Yeah, and have some 20-year-old engineer go, could you speak a little more clearly, Mr. Depp? He's like, do you know who I am? And then he goes into an Orson Welles rant, the famous Orson Welles rant.
You never know.
You can,
all right, you guys,
favorite.
We're going to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Andrew Steven and Sean Merrick and Roddy Swearingen. And, of course, John Thomas Griffith. He's the guy that wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
Yeah, still don't know who that is.
I'd also like to thank our storyteller tonight, Jonathan Shaw. Thank you again so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And on behalf of you, Hannah Svinney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories.
Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.
A few days ago, Brooke Tudine posted an inspirational quote on her wall that got 17 likes and 3 comments. Thumbs up, Brooke. Geico also wants to make a comment. In just 15 minutes, you could save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance by switching to Geico. And nothing says inspiration better than saving money. Well, except for those posters that say things like teamwork, excellence, and make it happen. Hashtag keep climbing. Hashtag savings.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.